Meeting of the. Yeah. Yeah, you had a. You were here.
No, this is
a
personal
football. Thanks. All right, look, bringing it back to regional government. This is a joint policy committee calling this to order. Do we have a quorum yet? Have we counted?
Yes.
We have a quorum. Yes, Fred says yes, so we have a quorum. We don't need to do roll call, right? All right, and first is just approval of the minutes of March 21st. Is there a motion?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. And by the way, you don't have to have been here to approve these minutes, right?
I will, though, because I'm not one of those that are much of a stickler.
Sure.
I will move the item, but I will recognize that there's a typo on page 3 under the public speaker. Novato is misspelled.
Okay. Mary catches these things at our board, so we know this. Mary is very careful when she
just
reads.
Just want to make sure staff knows that we're reading the minutes.
Okay, all right.
I would second the motion with the correction.
All right, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. One of our members who's been very involved in this next issue is going to be Zach Wasserman. Is going to be leaving to get. You're going to get honored, I understand, right, Zach? You're going to be honored. What are you getting honored for?
The Frank Berger Award from Bay Planning Coalition for leadership in the face of adversity.
Congratulations. And tell John Coleman hi when you go see John. So for that, we are going to move to item 4 because we wanted to make sure we covered it before you left. And then we'll come back to the HUD presentation. So item 4 is a report on JPC organizational planning proposal.
Thank you, Chairman. Well, I want to say, you know, I've been in the position for 6 months, and it's been a delight. And over that time, I have recognized that there's been a lot of progress in setting some structure and some impact that's occurred through the JPC. As I've gotten in this position, though, I do think that there's some continued work that could be done more on the kind of structural organizational components of the JPC, some documentation around policies, the role of staff, the mission of the JPC, but I do want to recognize, I've laid out a proposal working with the JPC member agency executive directors, and the executive committee met last week to discuss this and wanted to have this discussion here at the full JPC around a process for selecting a consultant to lead us through some organizational planning. And I've outlined in my memo some of the key functions that deliverables that this process would undertake and produce for this organization, really to set us up to have the impact that we all believe the JPC can have in the region around coordination and working with working on behalf of the four agencies. So, just to outline kind of the key components of this process, and then we can have some discussion around, and I have also included a draft RFP. It's a draft, so we can work from there. This would focus on clarifying roles, responsibilities, and functions, the development of organizational policies and bylaws, some core just organizational components, looking at best practices on how you take a complex entity like this and help it serve its highest and best purpose, and looking at things like matching resources with the work that we want to accomplish here, and the role of staff in helping to do that. So the budget proposed would be a maximum of $45,000 for this effort, and all four of the member agencies are going to contribute to that, to supporting that effort. We don't see this as being a long, drawn-out process. This would be a maximum, a six-month process, and it would include the process itself. It would certainly work with this committee and present at this committee, working with the executive committee and as well as the JPC member agency executive directors, and they will help guide this effort. So I will leave it at that. And to note,
I know there's been a lot of discussion among the four executive directors on this proposal and agreement. So I don't know if any of the executive directors wanted to add anything on this on the proposal?
I would like to say that we have worked, I think, very diligently over the last few years to define an appropriate role for the JPC, the projects we're undertaking, and the level of coordination. So I would hope that this report would take off from what we have already gained in terms of structure and scope, and not go too deeply into other concepts that we have been through in the last 5-10 years in discussion. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Are there... Jack?
John, on behalf of the Air District, though, at least from my perspective, I think this is a good thing, and we're in support of this. Mm-hmm. I think it'll help JPC move forward.
Great. Let me, before I go to the public, let me just go around to board members. Mary?
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to indicate on the agenda, I support the action moving forward, but on the agenda it indicates it's a report on an organizational planning process proposal versus action on the agenda. And the action is to move the RFP
right.
process
yeah.
forward. And I think that's there's a lack of transparency there with our public or those who may be interested in participating with this.
Okay.
Moving forward, I think we need to be a little more clear on
okay.
our agenda.
We'll make sure that it's an action. Okay.
Thank
yes.
you.
Okay. Any other comments? Everyone in agreement? All right. Public comment. Yes. I don't have a card.
Well,
you
I have
identify
it in my hand.
Identify
I
yourself.
I haven't got to you yet, but I'll get it to you. My name is Ken Bukowski. I'm a former council member. I want to suggest you go forward with this. I think it's a very good idea. But I'd like, since you talk about the budget, you may want to include a little bit for video because... you know, people don't attend meetings, and if you have a video recording of it, they can go back and take a look at it. You want to talk?
You've been
about
recording them for us, right?
Exactly.
Them on the
right.
web.
So all you got to do is link to it because
right.
it's going to be there forever. But
right.
For those of you that weren't here last night, you missed a very lively meeting, a lot to do with the process for Plan Bay Area, and so you may want to check with some colleagues, and I'll have it posted later today so that you can take a look at it if you want to look at it.
Okay.
The Tea Party was also here, and they recorded it, but I don't think they're going
yeah,
to get access to
it. Yeah, last night we had two radio recorders going on, yours and somebody else.
Yeah,
well, yes.
from the Tea Party.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway,
thank you. All right,
thank you.
Okay. Anybody else? All right, is there a motion then to move forward?
I'll move the item, Mr. Chairman.
Second.
Motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. And
thank you.
Zach can leave and get his award in the face of adversity.
I'm going
to
stay a little bit longer.
Oh,
I just didn't know how long the HUD presentation was going to be, and I'm certainly interested in it.
Which is next.
I have a few more minutes.
Item 3 is report on the HUD Sustainable Communities Regional Planning Grant, Economic Prosperity Working Group proposal, and I'll turn over to Miriam to introduce our presenters.
Good morning. Thank you, John. I would like to introduce the economic prosperity strategy that Egon Turplin and Stephen Levy will present to you. This is one of the 43 projects that we have under the HUD Grant Regional Prosperity Plan. This is probably the largest, but just to contextualize this specific project, we receive a $5 million grant, this is MTC and ABAG, to focus on how the implementation of Plan B area will address housing affordability, equity, and job mobility. The piece that you're going to hear, again, is one specific one that addresses job mobility, which is one of the key tasks in the region given the shrinking of the middle-income jobs. Again, what you're going to see this in other projects being released. We're entering the third phase, the third year of this grant, and you'll be see individual releases of these projects. Now, for your consideration, what the staff, ABAC and NTC staff will do, we will provide a compilation, a synthesis of those projects for our boards to discuss and assess what are the specific actions or strategies that you want to consider. But this is a broad consortium. We have had a really broad participation from local jurisdictions across the region. We have broad participation from stakeholders, from environmental organizations, housing organizations, labor organizations, workforce boards. So the reports, the consortium was built to include this diverse engagement, to include this diverse network of stakeholders. So you're going to hear different perspectives. That doesn't mean that those are the perspectives that ABAC or MTC are endorsing at this point. These are independent projects that will come to you for discussion and for deciding how you want to move this effort forward. But again, this is one of the largest pieces in this HUD grant, and it's already providing some interesting insights. Stephen and Egan, thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Miriam. Thank you very much, Alice and the Joint Policy Committee, for having us here. I'm Egon Terplin, the Regional Planning Director at SPUR, and my colleague working on this project with me, Steve Levy, who will also introduce himself. And we're going to be kind of going back and forth on a number of things. I wanted to just make a quick point in the beginning. It's wonderful for us to be here, the Joint Policy Committee. Some of you around the room have heard this presentation once, some twice, some maybe half a dozen or more times, but we're trying to tailor it a little bit to the context of this room. But just to give one sense, you all as a body are balancing different organizations and sometimes different interests and values and policies. That same approach in many ways was what we took into this project that we're talking about, as Miriam set it up, with a focus on economic mobility, but it's really balancing the idea of how to ensure that we have a robust regional economy with economic growth, but also one that, as we grow, lifts people up from the bottom, and people aren't stuck at the bottom. And balancing those two ideas is really core to what you're going to hear and that we've been struggling with. How do we come up with a set of strategies that really gets at doing that? And to kind of front load one of our main findings that relates to your work, implementation of Plan Bay Area is a core component of having a region with greater economic mobility. And we're going to get into why that is. But it's sort of, we're moving in the direction, but it's really thinking about some of those kind of land use, infrastructure investments, transportation questions from the perspective, in part, of making sure that those things lift people up, move them to the middle, and have an economic development pattern that creates more opportunities in the middle. What we want to do is just give a tiny word or two more of the background, some of the key findings that folks have heard that we think are directly relevant to this, and then really here kind of present to you some of the strategies we're talking about so that we can talk about it amongst the body here for your feedback and thoughts. As Miriam mentioned, there's a broad-based consortium working on this, but at the highest level, the federal government through HUD has funded this work in the Bay Area. But they, at the federal level, formed a partnership between three agencies, the Department of Transportation, HUD, and EPA. And so they're working across silos and jurisdictions, you know, across silos to invest in regional planning efforts. ABAG and MTC were the local recipients. And then our team that worked on the project included SPUR, Steve's group, Center for Continuing Study of the California Economy, a couple of labor organizations, kind of labor think tank groups, Working Partnerships, and the San Mateo County Union Community Alliance, and the Bay Area Council Economic Institute for some of the economic analysis. So we had a broad group amongst ourselves in moving forward the work of this particular project. What we did over the last year is combine two types of efforts. One was some technical analysis and a lot of analysis of workers and occupations and industries and understanding trends and what's happening there, and then a robust outreach process. So some of the recommendations and ideas that have come out of this emerge out of this process. We had 21 workshops in 7 subregions. Some of you were there. We were in Santa Rosa. We were in Concord. We were in Dublin, San Jose, San Francisco, Oakland, Redwood City, and had a series of meetings to hear from a broad range of people in each of those places. There was some additional funding to organizations working directly with low-wage workers to hear their specific challenges and barriers. So all of that kind of came together with what we're doing. I think one of the key ideas, and maybe I'll turn to Steve to mention a little of this, is this notion of how do we ensure that as we have a rising tide, that it really is lifting all boats. And that's I started off with that particular challenge, but Steve, I don't know if you want to say a word about that.
Okay, I'm Steve. We know that the JPC and ABAG are pursuing economic competitiveness issues. And while that was not our main objective, I wanted to take a couple of minutes to tell you how we think these results feed in to those goals. First, economic competitiveness means not only competing for businesses. Tough world, how can we get companies to continue to come here and expand? But in this region particularly, it involves competing for workers. We're asking talented people and other folks to come and live in a very high cost, getting more crowded region. A good job is not enough. So competition, as you go forward, has two parts. The good news is we live, you are part of a region where the businesses understand that. It's not always true. So when you pursue the project that I think you're beginning to hear from businesses, they're going to talk about housing and transportation and land use and education. And implicitly, whether they say it or not, they're going to talk about competing for workers. And the really good news for the four bodies that constitute JPC is that there really is a triple bottom line. Providing enough housing, having great schools, solving the transportation problem so that people and goods work, and as Akon said, implementing the rest of Plan Bay Area is an economic competitiveness strategy, it's a quality of life strategy, and it's environmental protection strategy. So as you go forward, remember we compete for workers, but we don't have to do anything different. We just keep on trucking with what we're doing. The second piece is what Akon said. Getting more high-tech companies, having the ones here expand and thrive is certainly part of economic competitiveness, but it's not the only part. This region, and particularly a successful region, will spend lots of money on teachers and nurses and doctors and plumbers and carpenters and nannies and gardeners. And a competitive region has to be able to house those people so that talented people in those occupations will come here and make this a competitive place for Google and Twitter and LinkedIn and all those other companies to expand. So what we call the twin goals, not forgetting people left behind, is really part of the first goal of securing economic competitiveness and getting these high-tech companies to come here because there are people here to do the service jobs. So Akon's going to take you through now some of the findings.
So
Hold on. Sorry. I blew what I spent all morning thinking about. You know that these projects don't run themselves. In a moment of unbridled enthusiasm or optimism or lack of clarity, Akon agreed to herd a bunch of rambunctious cattle. If you need anyone at any other time to do that task, he's your man.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate that. And if you want some knowledge about where we're all headed, then you can turn to this gentleman here. And as he illuminated a little bit. And some of the findings I want to quickly go through are ones that came out of the work Steve did and some from John Haveman and his work with the Economic Institute. But the starting point is that the workforce, the framing we initially did was lower wage workers in the Bay Area and how can they move up. And I think the first finding that was, in a sense, surprised us is 36% of the regional workforce is earning $18 an hour and less. Those are what we defined as lower wage workers. And about half of those people are close to minimum wage, and the other half are sprinkled between 11, 12, 13, 15, $16 an hour. So we really have in our economy a bunch of, you know, some folks down right close to minimum wage at 18%, another 18% sprinkled through up to 18, but that is a big portion of the Bay Area economy. It's a big portion of the entire workforce. And so our task was thinking about what happens. How do those people move up? And as you can see from these numbers, and we'll show you in other ones, There's a higher percent of folks at the top, kind of 30 and more, and we define this middle range of about 18 to 30 bucks an hour. So a job that might pay high 30s in annual salary to about 60 grand a year. That's the kind of definition of middle wage. And I think we all know Bay Area is an expensive place. So it's, we are looking at individual worker wages here, though, not household income. So as you think about it, there's many households, of course, with multiple workers. But that's the definition that we looked at here. The second finding is that this, thinking about workers who earn wages at the bottom, this is not isolated to certain cities and certain communities and certain neighborhoods. This is a regional challenge. There are workers at those wage levels in every community all across the entire Bay Area. And we looked at the concentration of that workforce in some of the high-need areas that are defined by some of your organizations, the care communities and some of those other areas, and you can see those outlined a little bit in pink if you look at it here. There is not a greater concentration of lower-wage workers in those places relative to the entire region. This workforce is spread all across the Bay Area. Another interesting idea, though, as we looked at that, is that workers who are lower-wage workers tend to have shorter commutes all across the Bay Area, in part because there are low-wage jobs distributed throughout the region. And so if we look at the people who are more likely to leave the county they live in for a job, they're more likely to have higher wages. So in a sense, regional mobility and its twin idea, accessibility, making sure when you leave your county, the stuff you want to get to is close by and convenient to access, that is an economic mobility goal. And it's important for opportunity that people can get out and access the good jobs that we have all over the Bay Area. When we looked at what are the differences between lower wage workers and the entire rest of the population, the entire workforce, one clear thing comes out, which is educational level. It's not a big surprise, but we looked across other demographic factors. Those are not profound differences. Even commuting, most people drive to work. Lower wage workers tend to take transit a tiny bit more, but by and large, not a huge amount more, except for bus level. But education level is really the key, which leads to, obviously, it's important from a strategy to think about education, but you'll hear some, it's not just the traditional college pathway that's important. Post-secondary that might involve certificates and other kind of training becomes key as well. The fourth finding is what I mentioned at the beginning, that we have an economy that has more jobs at the top and the bottom than in the middle. And so if we're really trying to move people up from the bottom into jobs and in the middle, we have to ensure that there's enough opportunity in the middle of the economic spectrum. And the data that we were using showed about 30,000 openings per year of middle-wage jobs. And a key finding is that those openings aren't all from job growth. An opening means a job that somebody can get, so it could come from an existing worker retiring or leaving or going to another job. And that's really the big economic opportunity, is to train people as baby boomers are retiring, to make sure that people have the skills and the training and the connections to get into those middle wage jobs.
Just to go back on that, yeah. I don't understand on that chart. So you're basically saying there's 500,000 job openings in the upper and lower.
Half a million at the top, 500,000 at the bottom, and 300,000 in the middle.
Got it. Okay.
And so we're talking about 1.1 million workers at the bottom that we're trying to move up into the middle, in theory, as many of them as possible, but there's only 300,000 openings in the middle. And those 300,000 openings in the middle, some people are going to take those who come from other parts of the country, other parts of the world. Some people might take a job, might be in a higher wage job, and they might be downwardly mobile. They might be someone else moving within a job within the middle wage spectrum. So it's not guaranteed if folks at the bottom can get into those jobs in the middle. But the math is simply that we need to grow that middle portion as much as we can.
Question? Do you have a breakdown on the under 18, what the wages scales goes to? I mean, does it go down to minimum wage? How many are the minimum wage? Do you have that breaking down?
We do. So about of this particular one, I don't think we did a chart of this, but it's about half of them are close to minimum wage, and the other half are kind of sprinkled all throughout, 12, 14, 16, kind of a range within there. The next finding, though, is back to that question of we really want to grow the middle, but what does it mean to grow the middle? And the reality is there's not some great middle-wage industry that we ought. If we could just grow that industry, that would really be the solution. Middle-wage jobs cut across every industry. And if you look at this list, these are the big, big industries where there's the most number of middle-wage job openings. they're the big industries in the Bay Area. Growing professional services and the construction services and healthcare, government, education, those are the big chunks of the Bay Area economy right there. And so middle-wage jobs will grow as the overall economy grows. But there is still a distribution within those industries that's somewhat different. And we can share this data for those that want to drill into it a little bit more. But the key is that some industries are a majority high-wage jobs or a majority low-wage jobs with a smaller share that are in the middle. For example, take food and drinking places. There are a lot of middle-wage jobs there if you look across the entire Bay Area, but by and large, it's not an industry where most of the jobs pay middle wages. In comparison, an industry like educational services is a great kind of well-distribution in terms of wages as an industry, and the same is true with healthcare, construction, some of the warehousing types of industries that are out there. And those kinds of industries, local economic development professionals, folks that are thinking about the regional scale, can think about how could we grow those industries particularly, make sure that we are competitive in those places.
So in your previous chart, you said 43% of jobs in seven industries. So you mean 43% of the middle-wage jobs are in these seven
industries, yes.
Which are the ones you're listing?
These are these seven industries. The ones here are taking those higher level.
Can you put that last one back up again? Okay.
And we can share all of this, and there's actually much more data in the draft report that we have out. One that's important to note here is government, which is not one that local economic development professionals have a lot of control over expanding, but is a huge opportunity in terms of an environment for people to get into. And there's going to be a lot of retirement in government at all levels.
And when you say ambulatory care, you're talking outpatient.
Exactly.
Sort of clinics.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's one that's very distinct.
So you don't combine it with hospitals. It's interesting, right?
It's how the data is broken out. Okay. You can combine them and call them healthcare, but they're two separate NAICS codes. If you combine them, they would be the largest one of this particular one here. So the distribution really does vary, and so this is something when economic development people are thinking about industries, you can look at it. But it's hard to see it here. The second one in terms of the biggest number of middle-wage jobs is in professional scientific and technical services. One of the biggest industries in the entire region, and that's really part of the knowledge work of the Bay Area, and that cuts across consultants to the kind of some of the growing technology companies that we have in our region. But the other side of this, though, is that the jobs that pay the lowest wages aren't going away, and they're probably going to grow over time. And if you look at the list, and this may, Mayor Bates gets to some of your questions, looking at some of these particular occupations that are out there, most of those are going to be around over the next couple of decades. And we can quibble and say retail salesperson is going to evolve and that might shift to being a local delivery truck driver as we see more of that type of consumer behavior. But home health aides and childcare workers and bartenders and food prep workers, janitors, teachers, those kinds of jobs are going to be around. And so the question becomes, as we look at the people in that workforce, a lot of those people are in those jobs for their entire career. And in fact, half, if you look at that middle chart, right, the middle bar, half of the people earning less than $18 an hour are over 35. So there's a strong argument these are not just jobs that people get into and spend a couple of years earlier on in their career and then move on into higher wage work. There's a lot of people that are in that kind of job throughout their entire career. So what that has led us to is thinking about how do we begin solving these issues. And the last finding, quote-unquote, is really core to this body and core to our thinking, which is we have to operate much more across silos. And some of those silos are geographic in terms of one individual jurisdiction is trying to solve all these issues on its own and figure out how to lift workers up as well as do economic competitiveness, all those issues are very difficult to do within one jurisdiction. As well as by topic. Often a workforce development board might be really thinking about these issues, how to come up with training, but they don't have employers enough at the table. Or they don't have the transportation operators at the table thinking about where the jobs are located and how workers are going to get there. Or the community itself isn't thinking about the provision of housing in the right way to make sure it matches what the kind of jobs that they have. So cutting across those silos is what we need to do, frankly, as a region. And I think this is really where we think Plan Bay Area is trying to move in that direction. And so that's really one of the core messages. So what we came to is really a think, somewhat kind of simple idea that to solve this challenge of lifting workers up at the bottom, we have to do three things. And the three things are, one, improve the pathways that people are on to get them up into the middle. Second, we have to grow the economy, because we saw that those industries cut across many, many wide range of industries and grow as the whole economy grows, but with an emphasis on the middle. But we also have to think about the workers who are left behind in those lower wage jobs and think about what we can do to upgrade the conditions of those particular jobs. So balancing those three ideas is sort of the core to what the economic strategy is. So I'm going to turn to Steve to talk about the first one, and then we're going to kind of go through the specific strategies we talk about and then open it up for a conversation.
The next one. We had a good deal of discussion with the EPWG and the steering committee about the boundaries of our research and who is supposed to carry it on. And I want to thank particularly Julie and Miriam for help us to clarify that. So the bottom line is, this is now a handoff. The strategies that we propose will be decided on by MTC and ABAG and the rest of you as to what you want to carry on. That's the bottom point. These findings are our findings, the research team's findings. That's what we were asked to do, and the findings from the outreach that we were asked to do. In the middle, you should know that implementation is already underway. That's one of the first things people usually ask. Is this going to just sit on the shelf or go somewhere? So our findings informed, I think, 10, was it 10 or 11?
10.
Pilot projects that have been underway since January to implement one or more of these strategies on a pilot basis. Okay? These are strategies. They're not recommendations. We weren't asked to tell anyone what to do. This was a particular point of, I won't say confusion, but of interest to the steering committee. Individual cities and counties, individual agencies can pick among these and do what they deem as best. We're not telling anyone what to do, but we are giving you our advice as to what might meet this goal. Go ahead with the next one. Okay. Biggest point is that education and training are economic competitiveness strategies. We looked at it from a mobility perspective, looking at low and moderate wage workers, but from the broader perspective that JPC has, most of these findings are essentially the same. Okay. 6 points. The first one relates to the expanding basic skills, and the concept there is contextualized learning. That means, at least for adults, you're teaching English language, you're teaching basic digital literacy in a job-related context. So there's a Department of Labor grant in San Mateo County where Skyline College is working with 4 hotels to teach immigrant workers English and job readiness skills in the context of their work at the hotel. There is a new program that Google is initiating with their janitorial contractors and their janitors to give the building maintenance folks tablets and teach them how to use them so they'll be more productive. They'll get orders and emails and help them make more efficient. Teaching these basic skills in a job-related context as opposed to just in a classroom. For the industry-driven partnerships, there are 2 points. One is the obvious one. People like me and workforce boards and colleges have spent a long time kind of guessing or looking at national forecasts of where jobs would be and what occupations and skills would be. Probably it's much better to partner with industries, find industries that are facing job growth or facing a retirement challenge, and get them involved in designing the curricula for training programs. Maybe they'll offer some internships or there'll be some apprenticeship offers, but really industry engagement so that what we're doing leads to jobs. Second point there is regional coordination. Two reasons. One, in an era that's short of money, we can't have every college or every workforce board like mine do every industry. This is a big regional labor market. Workers commute all over the place. Businesses hire all over the place. Many industries are region-wide. We need some specialization, some coordination. We're going to do this, you do that. Everybody gets covered, but everybody doesn't do everything. Free. On the ongoing career pathways, 3 points. There's a before point. Exciting high school students to understand the connection between what they're being asked to learn in school and getting a job. So there's a linked learning program. Antioch High School is part of the James Irvine Consortium of Models. Senate Leader Steinberg has a $250 million grant funds out there to develop model programs to get companies to come in, help students get excited about learning math or English or some other related skill. Maybe there's an internship. Get kids excited early. Second, the world of job search is changing. I mean, this is my world. I'm on two workforce boards. People go online. Your resume is screened by an automated process. It's a whole new world. No longer does somebody go in and have a face-to-face very often with an HR person in a company. It's a brand new world. You're going to need some digital literacy skills. You're going to need some help with your resume, knowing what employers are wanting. It's a brand new world. Second point. Last point, and this is something everybody can do, and that is mentoring and networking is really important. And one of our pilot programs with the Stride Center in Oakland, teaching basic ICT information community and technology skills to a somewhat disadvantaged and low-income group. Our workforce board is partnering to set up an alumni mentoring group. Everybody can do this. Any successful program has a group of alumni. Get them together, ask them to mentor, share their experiences with the people coming through the program now. It's enormously important. That's what. This is an economic competitiveness strategy. Businesses are going to tell you they really want to be partners, but this is not something you're going to learn how to do by asking businesses what they want. This is a separate set of inquiry for an economic competitiveness strategy.
So if that first goal is moving folks up into these middle wage jobs, as we noted before, you got to make sure there's enough in the middle. And this is our goal, too. And core to this, we broke it down into four strategies. The first is thinking about what we currently do in economic development and can it be done in a way that maximizes expansion of middle wage jobs. This doesn't mean that individual jurisdiction has to think about growing these jobs, but if you're interested in this question of middle wage jobs, focus on the kinds of industries that tend to have a broader range of them, whether they're in health or in construction or in tech support as an occupation. The technology sector writ large is much more diverse, but educational services and advanced manufacturing, those are the types of industries that tend to have a greater percentage of middle wage jobs. So that's one way to think about it. But another big opportunity, of course, comes from self-employment and entrepreneurship. And it's a risky proposition for a lot of people to give up jobs. So sometimes people, and I've talking with some people on the East Coast earlier this week who are working on this, trying to get people who might have a job now that's lower wage, if they have time, and this is a key issue, to be able to start a business on the side as part of their work, as self-employment. As that business scales, then maybe they can quit their full-time job. But you don't launch and quit your full-time job until you've had the opportunity to scale it up. But entrepreneurship increasingly is going to be key in self-employment for moving people into what are middle-wage jobs. Another key part, though, of the economic development question, this is jurisdictions know this, economic development professionals know this, is making sure that we coordinate better across jurisdictions. Permits, decisions, policies, sharing, and some places in the Tri-Valley, they've really done a good job of getting the cities to talk much more about this and share some of their language, share some of their policies and ordinances. The second part, though, of growing the economy is really the land use question, and key, I think you all know this, we need to build enough housing. Housing is extremely expensive in this region, but building housing in a way where we're simply using all of our industrial land as the place to build the housing is one that might undermine some of those middle-wage jobs that we have now that are going to be harder to bring back. In addition to the fact that we have to make sure that there's jobs in places that are accessible so those people who are commuting across county boundaries can get to a job that's easy to get to. So part of the idea here is really balancing these three ideas of making sure we build enough housing, but we don't cannibalize the industrial land or the really important space right near our regional transit system. At the same time that we also preserve and invest in industrial land on the A80 corridor and eastern Contra Costa County and a lot of other places where there are good middle-wage jobs and companies there now. And then making sure that we take some of our big institutions that drive a lot of the trips, the hospitals, the government offices, the major facilities, higher education, and put them right next to our regional transit system. Because we know that that's what's going to drive higher transit ridership is making sure the jobs are right there when you get off BART, when you get off Caltrain. So balancing those three ideas is really core to this. In places like Warm Springs and Fremont are thinking about this in a sophisticated way of coming up with a new model that's industrial development near a new BART station that's going to have some housing development, but in a way that's not just your kind of standard cookie-cutter version of transit-oriented development. And I think those kinds of models and thinking about the priority development area process in a way that's flexible, can have a really big job component, is an important part of the regional discussion. Then the last two components of growing the middle, one is infrastructure investment. And this is the sort of obvious win-win. We need it for economic competitiveness, and it creates great jobs. But it doesn't mean you just do any kind of infrastructure project. We want to do ones that support what's most important, and that's why the direction Plan Bay Area has gone of really having the right criteria of thinking about infrastructure. But it's more than transportation, as we all know. And we heard from a lot of people, don't forget about broadband, don't forget about energy, don't forget about water, sewer, these other systems. And I'd say one of the big messages we got is we have to come up with more ways as a region to fund some of this. And you know, a lot of counties and cities are really working on that, but that's really, we need to put a tremendous amount more. Lastly, though, is this idea of transportation and mobility. And I mentioned, people get better jobs when they cross county boundaries. Now, a lot of people are driving, and we know that that's kind of core to how most people are getting around. We also know that the goal of Plan Bay Area, these other things, is gradually shifting. We're shifting at the margins people that can take alternative modes. And so something like Clipper is a step in the right direction, but could that be expanded to be really a kind of a mobility ticket that's not just on all transit operators, but maybe it works on a ride-sharing program or an employer shuttle in rural Sonoma County where fixed-route transit's not going to be viable. You get some kind of a medium that really allows people to cut across the different systems that we have and increasingly look at how people get around as a network. And just one quick point to the state, I had a chance to meet with Chad Edison yesterday, the new Deputy Secretary for Transportation, who's really thinking about statewide in California, how do we have a network of transportation? You take a bus to BART, the BART train is right there. It happens in some context, but we are not planning this exactly in a way that really makes all of that seamless at each of the intersections that we have. And that kind of direction is going to be really important for both economic growth to make sure we don't have just clogged freeways, but also mobility and opportunity so people can get to the employment that's scattered all over the Bay Area. So those are the four strategies of the kind of grow the economy. But the last point, and I'm going to turn to Steve to talk about this, we said that we have to think about what happens to the folks who are in those jobs that pay the lowest wages today. What's the role of policy and thinking at the regional and the local level, as well as state and federal, in thinking about this?
Okay. Before I do this, let me just underscore. You remember at the beginning, Aegon said implementing Plan Bay Area is the key to economic competitiveness and the twin goals of prosperity. But if you think of economic competitiveness as creating great places to work and live, BCDC and the Air Quality District are part of economic competitiveness. They're part of creating great places to live that attract workers that come and support the companies. Everybody in the room is part of an economic competitiveness strategy. When we found out that there were only 300,000 middle-wage job openings for 1 million-plus low- and moderate-wage workers, and that there would, in fact, in 2020 be more low- and moderate-wage jobs, we went immediately to thinking about what could be done to improve the conditions of people that stay there. And as the slide shows, a lot of the heavy lifting is done by federal and state actions. Local governments don't control the tax code, don't control immigration policy, and a lot of other things. But we were asked to suggest what local agencies might do in addition to their traditional role of advocating at the state and the federal level. And it turns out that there are a number of things that individual jurisdictions in the area have done. And this idea from Louise at Working Partnerships that not everybody has to do everything, but if one city does something that's a really great model, it might be a best practice for state and federal legislation. We're an innovative region. Okay, I'm going to go through this pretty quickly.
And this is the last section.
It is.
So the last point.
There are cities in the region that are adopting or thinking about adopting higher minimum wages, earned sick leave provisions, some stronger worker safety and wage enforcement than is in state law. That's an area of innovation. For people that remain in low-wage industries, can we develop partnerships with companies to help them move up, even if they move up from $12 to $17 an hour? So there's a San Francisco Hotels partnership, or one of the Skyline college projects works with an industry to help people develop career pathways. Can we professionalize some industries? One of the friends of Aegon and mine is working on how do you professionalize the security guard industry like was done with janitors so that those people have better working conditions and benefits. And then some of the project members reminded us that there is often public money involved and local jurisdictions can leverage some benefits, some agreements that help low and moderate wage workers out of the expenditure of public money, so that there are things cities here can consider to do or do as models for federal and state action.
So just a kind of closing point on this and across the whole thing, I think part of what we came to is that individual jurisdictions can be innovative and can be models, but we're more successful if some of these things get tried across. And just look at some of the examples here. The minimum wage is a very live debate in a number of cities, not all of them. But if every city had its own minimum wage that were different, it sort of wrecks havoc and it creates a lot. It's not as effective.
That's why Tom's idea to make it regional, which is what you suggested, having each city sort of adopt similar exemptions and similar wages.
And that's exactly and something we heard about, and I would love to. And that's part of a message that we heard a lot, and it relates to the idea of sharing, having similar language around industrial zoning and model ordinance, and it's similar to the idea of having a more common permit processing.
Yes.
The definition of the number of businesses, the small businesses, you know, what's a small business across jurisdiction? What's the wage level? How many years does it take to get to a certain idea? So that idea is one that we think is really, at least for this component of the work, something that's very much at a regional scale. So that's what we've learned. That's what the project is. It's we would love to have your discussion. And I think, as Steve mentioned, this is now, we are just right now editing the final report, and then it really becomes a handoff for the final year of the HUD grant project, and then ultimately for all your boards to think about how this this moves forward and becomes implemented. So we welcome your comments and questions. Thank you.
Thank you. And I know the purpose of this was sort of to give us an update. And ultimately, a lot of the work that will occur in implementing the existing Plan Bay Area and the development. I know last night there was already discussion at ABAG of what kind of process to follow for the development of the update to Plan Bay Area. These are the kinds of factors that will help achieve the broader goal. So this helps inform these other processes. Right. So comments on this? Mark.
I guess I had a question, and maybe it's implied in some of your conclusions, but has there been a look at, for those people who have moved across income boundaries, what was their path? I mean, I expect the path for a janitor to higher income is probably different than a path for a nursing assistant, and so that you could then target, if you could learn from that, then target removing barriers along that path.
My workforce board, I know of one example. As part of our Stride Center work to create career pathways for these beginning ICT workers, we examined and interviewed a number of successful people who did move up within the ICT industry and asked them what was critical for their ability to move up, which is one of the places where the idea of networking and mentoring came from. I think it's a really good idea, and it can be part of building and utilizing these alumni groups in any successful project, that they can share their experiences back of how they moved up after the original training. It's a great idea.
Okay. Other comments? There's no action on this item. Ezra?
You said that you thought Plan Bay Area was on the right track, and we were thinking about expanding the scope of Plan Bay Area to include economic competitiveness and prosperity as an outcome that's desired not just as a metric but as a strategy related to some of our most critical problems regarding housing and transportation. But some of what you're talking about involves education, certifications, and I think the community college system could have a lot to do with how to improve performance. There is a community college consortium.
Yes.
And they're represented at the Bay Area Council Economic Institute. And they made a presentation in this critique of our current master plan structure that they're incredibly overregulated and they can't do anything without seeking permission from some entity that doesn't even meet, they explain that they really can't partner with high schools. It's very difficult to partner with industry and all the things you're talking about. So I think the more we get involved in this, the more we need to think about how we institutionalize these results, because otherwise we might lose them. And so I'm going to recommend or advise that ABAG will take a closer look at how we can incorporate the Bay Area Council Economic Institute, for which we are founding members, to give us recommendations as to what we can utilize to buttress Plan Bay Area's mission of economic competitiveness and prosperity. And therefore try to capture some of these findings in a more permanent institutional remedy.
Just a quick comment. I think you're absolutely right that there's some of those institutional barriers at the state level, and that's why a number of the things we talked about you keep bumping up against, and we can't solve this at the scale of the Bay Area. But we can cut across those boundaries, and the Transportation Agency, the Air District, the others saying, this is actually important for the work we're doing to make sure that we have a viable future to have some of these state changes that would affect those. But a real simple change. So, I mean, the community colleges, the WIBs, they could have a seat at the ABAG Regional Planning Committee, that you can incorporate some of those entities into existing conversations. And then the flip side, I think when you think about community colleges and where they're located in the region, in a lot of places they're at the end of a road on land that was relatively inexpensive and everyone has to drive there, and then the transit operator's got to come up with extra money to have a bus that goes out there because there's a lot of transit ridership. But just connecting the dots, when they open a new campus, Is it going to be on El Camino Real near a BRT station? Some of those kind of basic things would link the location of the great work they're doing with some of the Plan Bay Area thinking.
Yeah. Let me add one point. I'm going down in 2 weeks to make this presentation now for the second time to SCAG. They are interested in the twin goals of a rising tide and lifting all boats. If we're talking about state policy or state policy barriers, I would offer myself, but really encourage ABAG and SCAG and the regional agencies in the two biggest regions in the state to get together and become a voice to Sacramento if there are things we need to do that are statewide.
One of the comments I wanted to make was I appreciate this identification of the issue here. Look at my notes, that we need to work out of our silos. And you gave the example of by geography where individual jurisdictions often work in isolation and the land use separate from workforce development. And one of the examples you gave is that we don't need to set up a training program in every community college because that takes time and money and recreates the wheel, but maybe you have a community college in the East Bay, one in the South Bay. I think you've said, and I've heard Sean Randolph say, we need to stop competing against each other within the Bay Area because we're really competing against other metropolitan areas around the world. And so to the extent when the Bay Area does better, every region does better. So we often get, you know, one county does its own economic development plan, which is useful, but what we end up doing is figuring out how to steal jobs from another county in the Bay Area into ours, which doesn't really help the region. It may help us in the short term, but in the long term really doesn't, because if we're not creating a good business environment in the Bay Area, I mean, we want to attract more jobs into the Bay Area, not just shift them from Santa Clara to San Francisco or Alameda or Contra Costa, but shifting jobs into the Bay Area from other areas. I mean, and all the evidence shows that's the most effective strategy, and Sean Randolph from the Economic Institute says the same. So what kind of advice and comments do you have as we think about that and maybe how this moves forward to get us to think that way so that we're really improving prospects for the whole Bay Area?
One, you know, it's a really hard question. I live in Palo Alto, and I see the flip side, which is that the region needs housing, more housing at all levels to compete, and individual cities have local land use control, and citizens have different views about that. That's another way that we're unable to think as a region. I think the key to all of this, and I don't know whether it's going to be successful, is to get people to understand the connection between the things that make the quality of life great and economic competitiveness. If every city acts like a silo, the jobs will eventually go away. No one city can see their part of being a regional economic competitiveness center. They think, if I don't have housing, the jobs will still be here. And so it's that connection that we have to get people to see if we're going to have jurisdictions act together.
Right.
But I agree with you.
Sean makes this point, Sean Randolph, every time he makes a presentation. And so, I mean, and of course, you know, part of it, though, is how we get ourselves thinking out of our silos and what incentives exist to get us to do that.
I was going to just mention two additional things. I think you're absolutely right, and it's something we've normally mentioned but didn't highlight today. One is that there's some great examples of sub-regional economic development groups like the East Bay EDA and the Silicon Valley Economic Development Alliance, where you get the economic development professionals sitting down with each other, talking, sharing ideas, saying, well, hey, we're really trying to grow advanced manufacturing in the South Bay. And Kim Wallace in San Jose is doing this, connecting with Morgan Hill and Fremont in an advanced manufacturing partnership of cities that really care about that. That type of collaboration is key, and I think is really happening on the staff level. The elected officials then need to also support that effort and make sure that they're not trying to encourage companies from one jurisdiction to move to the next. And I think we're moving very well, I think, in that direction for some of those entities. The second piece is something that's somewhat controversial, and we put as a sidebar in the report, but is that it's been talked about for years, but thinking about how the fiscal incentives for cities to think about jobs, that the benefits accrue to them locally. And moving or considering a possible pilot around tax sharing, of some type of a tax it grows, and as it grows, it gets distributed across jurisdictions so that all the benefits of jobs don't just accrue to one jurisdiction. Right. That's the kind of thing that would change some of that incentive structure.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, let's get comments, and then who's over here? And then we'll go to speaker. Mark Ross, Julie, and then Mary.
Okay, thanks.
And Scott. And Scott, okay, we'll go.
Thanks, great presentation, guys. Appreciate it. And I'll just stick to cars and trucks and land use very quickly. The Alhambra High School. I'm from Martinez. Our vocational aspect we have there is auto shop. Not a lot of schools have auto shop, and our kids are going to the Nationals again for the third time in a row. We kick butt, but we've traditionally always had auto shop in Martinez. And they're going to earn six figures. A couple of them already have six-figure jobs, and they're in high school. I mean, opportunities, and they're in high school. They're already working at dealerships. And those are the opportunities that get overlooked. And I asked somebody in our community, how can we always win? And they said, well, that's because nobody else does it. I mean, the competition list they have in these competitions is very short, and these jobs are overlooked because they're computer savvy. Everybody thinks that they're doing wrench work. They're not. They're testing things. And so that gets overlooked, and I think there's ample opportunities in our educational system, and especially with community colleges. I want to echo that again. I work with community colleges, especially, and if you're in Contra Costa, vote yes on E, by the way, this June. But that's the opportunity ladder that I see for a lot of people that have jobs right now, and they want to move up. That's their opportunity. Getting the associate's degree is their first degree for many of them, college degree in their whole family, in their whole history. And the community colleges, it's correct, they are looking for some way to jump into this. And they are, and the students and the people aren't waiting for this. Their classes are jammed. The physical classes are jammed. The online courses are jammed. They're already availing themselves of this. And there's got to be a way. We got to get that even more refined and respected. The other thing I'm going to say is about cars and trucks, keep on the cars and trucks theme, is the delivery of goods and services, perhaps between the hours of the carpool lanes for commuters, that those be reserved for the delivery of goods and services. The larger vehicles are our biggest emitters. If they had a faster pathway to deliver services and goods, especially if we're doing more home entrepreneurship that relies on the UPS deliveries and those types of services, we're going to have more of those vehicles on the road. I know many of those vehicles are already going to low emissions type delivery systems, but those are going to be crucial to be able to move goods and services so they're effective. Also, the warehouses that they come from and they distribute from are going to have to be more centrally located. And that leads to, again, to the zoning, which I've talked about again, is having industrial parks. Industrial parks are I'm in property management, cannot find any, people call us all the time looking for auto shop space, light industrial space, ain't happening, sorry. Landlords are raising the rents on them because they realize they have an incredibly valuable commodity. All these places are getting turned into residential uses, and now they're being located farther and farther out, which creates more emissions, longer travel time, less services. Getting a pool guy to fix a pool cover, a retractable pool cover, it's 5 weeks because they have to locate in Lodi, and they can only do two or three Bay Area visits a day because they have to travel so far because they cannot get light industrial space at a reasonable cost in the area. So outside of the hardcore residential ring right around transit or our high-density areas, there should be a second ring reserved for the service commercial areas so that they don't have to travel that far. The job opportunities are local, and they can access all these services that are going to be needed. And I'll shut up now. Thanks.
Okay. Julie?
Yeah, just real quickly. I think It's been fascinating as this study has been evolving, and I want to thank Egon and Steve and the whole crew, because it's a big group of folks that have put this information together. It occurs to me a couple of points as we go through this, and it builds on what Ezra was just talking about, the presentation we had at the Economic Institute a couple of weeks ago, and how the different levels of our educational system are somewhat hamstrung in how they can coordinate their work, because the high schools and the community colleges don't really communicate as well as they should. Community colleges and the university system, there are strata of opportunities even in the university system about who can do what and who they can talk to and how they can interact. So that's a problem. But a bigger problem even is how they interact on the educational level with the business, the commercial, the industrial level, because that communication is not as strong as it needs to be. We're getting there. We're building on it. You're recommending more of that in the study. And I wonder if it's bigger than just a regional thing. Steve said he's going down to talk to SCAG. It occurs to me that, and this is way out of the purview of your study, and I understand that, but that maybe we as ABAG and MTC as members of the California Council of Governments might bring that up to a higher statewide audience and then come up with some recommendations that we can actually take to Sacramento to institutionalize some of these concepts statewide, so we're not competing as much with ourselves. Certainly, we're looking out for the Bay Area, but California as a whole really is part of that. So, anyway, just some thoughts that maybe this needs to be taken to a broader discussion.
I've been trying, clearly unsuccessfully now, yes, for 3 years to get Hassan and Egon and Mike McKeever and the MTC folks together as a group to go to Jerry Brown and Daryl Steinberg with a set of common issues. I am convinced that at the state level, they see a lot of interest groups, but they don't see the regional planning and transportation agencies. And I just think, because I work for at least three of them, that there are amazing common interests that don't get voiced. So I completely, yes, support that.
And we're going to finish up with our speakers, and then, because we need to move on to another important item we need to talk about, Mary and Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to echo Ezra's comments about the local educational opportunities, whether it's at the community college, the four-year college campus, or our trade and technical programs. Our area is rich with educational opportunities, and I really see that as a driver behind increasing wages is through increasing education and that experience. We cannot discount their relevance. Whether they're geographically desirable or not, there's access online. I mean, we just need to heavily promote education and what it means to the bottom line in income to families. The motto about the tide must lift all boats should also include the responsibility for those in the boats to row. I want to see and hear more of that, and I didn't get that today, and I think it's really, really important to the big picture. Wanted to make sure that we also see included our other partners. I didn't hear or see a mention of family. And I think that's the root, that's really the beginning thread of how we're going to raise and increase exposure to education and the need to strive for increased wages. But begins with family, includes the faith community. It includes community after-school programs, which I didn't hear enough of. I know John and West County, you have the RISE Center. There's many throughout the Bay Area. For whatever reason, I didn't hear or see that. And the job shift, I disagree with you a little bit, John. The job shift should include shifting jobs to where the houses are. And particularly in East County,
You move jobs out to East County. You may have a local impact here, but there are other folks here to fill those jobs, and then you reduce impacts on our highway infrastructure, and you decrease greenhouse gas emissions, and you improve quality of life. So I think job shifting is an element of prosperity for all communities, and I don't want to be a no to that. I think that's a balance, but I think it's an important part of the balance. And lastly, the Northern Waterfront Initiative that Contra Costa County's taken on, you didn't mention it, but maybe you're aware of it, to protect the industrially zoned properties within our communities so that they don't get lost because of their significant economic advantage for not only our local cities, counties, but the region as a whole. So, Mr. Chairman, just some thoughts respectfully to the big picture and maybe some other points to consider. Thank you.
And Mary, I want to be clear. I wasn't saying that we shouldn't think about, you know, where to locate jobs. I was sort of implying we need to make sure we put as much energy about expanding, as we expand the jobs and businesses here in the Bay Area, we expand them to areas like you mentioned where there is housing, and not just focus on shifting the jobs from one part of the Bay Area to another. That because then we're just dealing with this, we're stagnant on job growth, and we're shifting it, moving the chairs around on the deck. Whereas as we look at expanding our job growth, bringing it to the areas like you mentioned where there is housing, right? Tom,
thanks, John. I'm taking Scott's place. Scott left. You said he wanted me to. Reflect
Scott,
his point of view.
And we're going to have to wrap this up because we have another item. Okay.
Well, I have to reflect Scott's point of view.
Yes. And your own, hopefully. Not going to tell us which is yours and which is Scott's idea. So
this is all mine. No, what I was thinking, and I wanted to pick up on this because I think Mark raised a really interesting point. Honestly, an interesting point. And I think we have all of these jurisdictions that are all independent, and they're going to remain independent. They're going to make individual decisions based on what they think is best for their citizens or their region. I mean, not the region so much, but individual little parts of the region. And so I think it gets down to and is trying to figure out how we can do something around the tax code to incentivize the right kind of growth, because without that, I think we're really lost, because it's hard to say we got to save, example, light industry, some things that zone for light or heavy industry. I mean, people make decisions. Well, we need housing. We need these. We're going to get a Walmart or something. So we're going to do this. But if there was a way to think about, having something like a Williamson Act that would be enacted to say that would be economically in the interest of the property owners to save that land and put that land and keep that land in that kind of form and not have it evolve out of that. I think that's a really interesting point. The other thing is, I just want to say quickly that we in Berkeley are very fortunate to have a community college, Berkeley City College. And so we found that working with them, we've been able to articulate courses between the high school and the community college. People are taking classes now in high school that qualify them for college classes, and we're figuring out ways of doing, job training, and we just got a grant, a Lumina grant, that's going to help us even more. So I think there's some examples that can be shared in the region, and people don't have to reinvent everything. So I would say we should try to figure out some best practices that are happening in the region. I know that in Vianza and Foothill, and there's a lot of really interesting community colleges that are doing a lot of interesting stuff, so we had to try to gather that and try to figure out how we can expand upon it.
Thank you. All right, so we have one public comment card, Pat Eklund, who was also here last night till 10.
You just have to get close to it. Yeah, just get close to it.
I'm Pat Eklund with the City of Novato, and every time I hear this presentation, I've heard it probably four or five times, I've learned something new, which is really fantastic. I am not convinced that we really need to expand the Plan Bay Area to deal with economic competitiveness, because I think there's already elements in the Plan Bay Area that lends itself to strengthening those particular aspects of it. Highly recommend that the Joint Policy Committee gives a presentation, Egan and Steve or others, at the CCS Partnership. It's a statewide organization composed of cities, counties, and school boards. And I happen to be on the board as well as John. And that brings government together, local government. And educational communities is a big partner in this, but when I look around this table, education is not sitting here. And they really need to be a partner in implementing some of these items that are listed. I also think that this Joint Policy Committee could invite the Community College Association and the school boards in this area and have a similar presentation, maybe shorten a little bit, but actually have discussion about what they can do in the Bay Area. I just wanted to mention an example in Novato, and Tom mentioned the example in his area, and I think there's examples across the Bay Area. The city of Novato, we're not rich, but we invested $300,000 to initiate which is called a Life Science Alliance. It's composed of representatives from Marin, Sonoma, Napa, and Solano in government as well as industry and in education. In fact, our community college in Marin County is actually a leading member of that alliance. And so what we're doing is we're hooking up the biotechs, the Buck Center Institute, BioMarin, which is a huge drug manufacturing dealing with orphan drugs. And we're creating more education at our community colleges that can help feed that industry in that four-county Bay Area. So I think that this example and others could really lend to putting some specific examples of what communities can do and then sort of taking a roadshow out there. So just comments from the peanut gallery.
Thank you very much. Okay, last speaker card I have. Good discussion, good presentation. We're going to have follow-up on this. I know we are. This is great.
Thank you very much for all your comments.
And I got some talking points for a talk I'm giving this afternoon on an anti-poverty effort in Contra Costa with all these service organizations about the element, this element which is really ties in with regionally. So this has helped me on this, too. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see the sign up. Adrian.
Just quickly, you know, I appreciate the comments about education, but, you know, we're starting here at the community college level. But if you look at some of our communities, surprisingly enough, in our county, San Mateo County is a fairly wealthy county.
Yeah.
But we have 48% of our children can't read proficiently at third grade. And so if that bottom line is they aren't reading at third grade level when they get to third grade, the chance of them going on to community college or getting through high school. So
K-12.
Although, we can't do everything, but I do think in our cities and our counties that we can do things that we are in our called a big lift where we're trying to get to those children. It takes an investment. And so, you know, as we do this, it would be helpful to encourage our cities and our counties to work more closely with education at a very young age because it's too late. You know, 48% is a huge... I mean, I was astounded when I heard that percentage. So I throw that out there because we keep talking at the community college level, but you got to get there. So part of this should include some of that discussion as well.
That's a good point. Thanks, Adrian. All right. So we are moving on to item number 5, report on cap and trade investment plan EnviroScreen, and I'm just going to make a brief opening comment about this. This is a really important issue. As you all know, the governor's budget contains proposals on how to spend cap and trade revenue. And in 2015, as fuels come under the cap, those revenues are going to go up substantially. And there is a state law that says that 10% of cap and trade revenues need to be spent in impacted communities and 25% to benefit impacted communities. And the state EPA or OEHA, which stands for Office of,
Environmental Health Hazard Assessment,
has come up with these maps, EnviroScreen maps, which rank the most impacted communities under a number of variables in the state. You know, there's a good and a bad news, right? The good news is that when you look at the Bay Area compared to other parts of the state, we don't have as many of those areas, and from an environmental standpoint, that's a good thing. the bad side of it, it means that there are very few communities in the Bay Area that are listed to essentially to be eligible as impacted communities for the 25% of cap and trade revenues that will benefit impacted communities. So it's one of those. So there's been a lot of discussion about how, whether this is the right tool to use, whether there needs to be fine tuning of this tool, because as at a minimum 25%, it looks like this is really a floor, not a ceiling. 25% of cap and trade revenues will be spent to benefit impacted communities around the state, and we need to advocate as a region for sort of an equitable distribution that goes to impacted communities here in the Bay Area that may not be on the statewide list. So that's sort of the framing of this. So, Jack, are you starting this off?
Actually, I think you have Gene that's going to provide
right.
you with this.
And we've had some great maps, and I don't know if you're going to show those here.
So I have the maps. I can hand them out.
I think you should hand them out.
Okay. So, sorry about that.
But, John, I think you did a good job of summarizing the
big that's issue. That's the nutshell
right.
issue.
I think
right.
that's the summary.
And it is clear, and I know this issue has been conveyed to Cali PA, that this is an important issue for us in the region.
There's more here. So there's a tool that the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment has been developing called Cal EnviroScreen, and they're now on their second version of this tool to identify areas in California that are impacted and disadvantaged. And as Chair Gioia mentioned, this question of how the cap and trade proceeds will be allocated, the proposal is to use this tool. It's a tool we've been tracking at the Air District for a while now and commenting on it along the way. And the most recent version of the tool, the result is a draft, and there's a comment period that is open now. And we are in the midst of crafting some comments on this tool that are basically on the substance of the tool, the factors that it considers, how it weights them, but also on how this tool might be used, in particular on this cap and trade proceeds question. One of the things that has happened is that in this tool, it focuses on some certain characteristics of the population's pollution burden, air pollution.
Go through the variables that are utilized.
I also have that. I wasn't sure how much
I would think
paper
it's really,
people want.
Why don't you hand that out. So we see the variables that are utilized.
Okay. Some more paper coming. So there are a number of pollution burden variables. Ozone concentrations, ground-level ozone concentrations, particulate matter concentrations, diesel particulate matter, water quality, pesticides, toxics, releases from facilities, groundwater threats. You'll see the whole list as it comes around. So some pollution burden for various communities, but then also population characteristics, children and elderly in the community, asthma, department visits, educational attainment, low birth weight, linguistic isolation, poverty and unemployment. So this tool that OEHA has put together looks at all these factors for every census tract in the state and combines them and gives a ranking score for each census tract.
And by the way, what you're hearing, if you look at page 9, you will see the map of the state. And the areas in red, right, are the identified areas, and you could see where most of them are located, where the Bay Area is, and then there are individual maps. But I think this map sort of gives you a perspective.
Right. So there's some technical issues, we believe, with the tool, and there's a letter at your places that identifies some of the Air District's concerns about the tool itself. And those are important, I think, for at least the Air District and maybe the other agencies to make those points. I think the larger question is this tool going to be used for allocating out money? And if so, we might have concerns about that, given that the Bay Area doesn't have very many of these census tracts as the model is currently. And the letter that in front of you points out some of those issues and suggests an alternative way of allocating those funds if the tool can't be modified in time or in ways that really recognize the level of impacts in the region. There's certainly an understanding that other regions of the state have serious quality of life issues, have significant poverty levels and pollution impacts, but the Bay Area has its own areas of impact. Our care communities, MTCs, communities of concerns, we definitely have relative impacts in our region that we think are worthy of recognition and benefits from the state and the proceeds from cap and trade. So there's a draft. I'll be glad to answer questions to the extent that I can on the tool itself. I think the interest of the executive directors and discussion at the executive committee of JPC was that potentially there could be a letter jointly from the agencies at JPC to comment on the tool and its use in cap and trade revenue proceeds. And we've in this draft of the letter suggested an approach that we might use. And in discussions with Alex from MTC, there might be some good modifications to that approach of how we might get funds to the impacted communities in the Bay Area without using CalEnviro screen itself.
Right. So. And one thought I know we've talked about is having the letter by the four agencies stress the issue of equity around the state. I mean, this given that this is a very large revenue stream, that we do have our identified impacted communities, and Gene, as you point out, through care communities by the Air District, because I do think from a policy perspective, while it's useful getting into the details here with the state about how the tool should change, that from a policy perspective, that the governor's office is going to be concerned about ensuring that there's some level of equity and that a region of the state not get left out in a big way. And I know you talked about the fact that not many communities in San Diego are also identified here as well. It's predominantly the Los Angeles region and the Central Valley. And so in having spoken also to Matt Rodriguez, who's the Cal EPA director who lives in Castro Valley, I mean, I think there's been a lot of concern expressed about the equity, and I think we should include that as part of our letter. And while we're not trying to, you know, avoid expenditure in impacted communities, that, as you point out, there's some unique issues with impacted communities here in the Bay Area, and they don't show up on the list. Mm-hmm. Because that's going to make them look at this from a larger, bigger equity standpoint and not just the details of the tool.
So to add to Gene's remarks, John, I think what it would be, I think... to land in a good place for JPC would be for us to insist that Cal EPA actually seek to be able to update the CalEnviro screen, because so far I haven't, while I've talked to Secretary Rodriguez as well, I haven't heard a response back affirmatively that indeed they will seek to be able to amend the CalEnviro screen tool, which I think is something very important for us to get from them.
Right.
Because there's a fair amount of technical details here that we need to have them agree with. And I think there is some sense that they could meet us more than halfway on a lot of the technical points. In the end of the day, though, we are talking hundreds of millions of dollars could sway here based on all of this. And so I think what we should do is insist that Cal EPA commit to update and revise the CalEnviro screen.
Well, I mean, there would be probably less interest in this tool if it wasn't attached to how to spend 25% of the cap and trade revenues. because it's sort of being attached, although they haven't made a final decision that this is the tool they're going to use, right? I mean, it's still possible that but I think we have to assume that they are.
The document on the CalEnviro screen points out that that's the intent.
Right.
Yeah.
So the intent here is to provide direction that maybe we get all four agencies to jointly sign a letter to Cal EPA, frankly. And this frankly should go not just, I know it's going to, you have your Dr. John Fowles, but also to Matt Rodriguez, that actually, as a region, indicates our concern about the use of the tool? Pardon? Yes, I think it has everybody. Yes, yes. Comments by first of all, comments from the JPC members. Any comments? Ezra's pointing over. Who's?
Mr. Chairman, Alex? Do we?
Yeah.
I can ask the question. On the agenda, it's indicated as a report, but there's action being requested. Do we have enough voting members to vote on action?
I think what we're doing is just getting a sense.
Consensus.
Technically, yeah. Because actually, the four agency executive directors have already talked about wanting to write a letter, so they're sort of checking in with us, and we're providing some direction on
It's a polite question. Yes. Do they need direction from us? I mean, I think in the role,
I think they sort of know. We talked about this at exec committee, too.
So you're not looking for direction. You're just sharing that we're going to do a joint
letter. Well, I think they're
looking. Looking across at staff.
Well, no, they can take input from us, how to improve their letter. So if comments about how
to improve
their letter.
It's not if we want to do a letter. Right. We're doing a letter, and if you want to provide inputs, which I think is great. I mean, that's what you should be doing. So I just want to clarify, Mr. Chairman, what the request is of the body here. Thank you.
And the question is, does it come from the JPC or the four agencies? I just think from the four agencies, you know, in some way is really important.
Could we do all?
Yeah. JPC.
Separate and a joint?
I think one joint letter probably makes the most sense with all four agencies on one letter. It indicates strength, right?
John, I think that would make sense, but I also think the district will likely provide its own separate letter on the technical details, by the way, because it's air quality to air quality agencies back and forth. But I do think a letter from JPC, either all four EDs or something from the JPC itself, would work.
Should be the chairs.
Yeah.
Let me say that Zach, before he left, indicated that he's all for the letter as proposed and willing to support. But anyway.
So you had a comment?
Yes, I just wanted to note MTC would have significant concerns about the CalEnviro screen being used as it is or maybe at all for the cap and trade revenue.
Right.
So I just wanted to add one potential addition to the letter. Uh-huh. I think that what's laid out in the letter and the two-step method makes a lot of sense for cap and trade revenues that are going to be administered by a statewide agency. But MTC's advocacy principles would have some of the cap and trade revenue coming directly to MPOs, to other regional agencies such as, you know, the Air District. We're focused obviously on the transportation revenues to the MPOs. So I would offer up maybe an addition that for cap and trade funding administered by MPOs or Air District or other regional local entities, to allow a distribution of funds for the benefit or within disadvantaged communities based on a localized method. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of the step two that's outlined in the process.
And, you know, inherent in that, some of us who were here the night that we approved Plan Bay Area included a provision, this history is really important, that says that the same 10 and 25% ratio for funds that come through MTC and ABAG and we defined impacted communities. We didn't define it, so we sort of anticipated that issue, that it would be our own definition, that we believe it's important to apply the state standard the same way in the Bay Area, and that's policy in Plan Bay Area. But we were general in how we defined it. And I think Ezra, as we were writing it up that night, was pointing out we may not want to define it the same way that the state is defining it. So I think that's a good point to make, but it's important to say we're going to apply it the same way. It's just that our definition are going to be, you know, the standard of impacted communities that we looked at.
Right, and then it speaks in the letter that the Air District wrote. They noted that then the CARE communities the communities of concern, which you know, had a lot of vetting, within the regional within our region, then those could be used. And I think that's really important. And there is a model. With another program, the Active Transportation Program, that required a specific set-aside for disadvantaged communities, they did allow for regions to propose what they wanted to use for disadvantaged communities, but it had to be approved in that case by the CTC. So we could even propose that Cal EPA could review these local methods, these localized methods for anyway. So I would add something like that to the letter to make sure that we capture that.
Right, we could, yeah. And there's a lot, I mean, there's a lot that's going to still yet be determined depending on how the budget comes out for cap and trade, right? Mark?
Yeah, I guess I just hope we take a statewide view of this. That, I mean, I think it is a good objective to target disadvantaged mm-hmm. communities, mm-hmm. and what we need is a good tool for doing
right.
that and not look at it simply as where is the money flowing.
Yep. Right.
And so, I mean, right. I look at this map, and it's probably an area that doesn't get a lot of money in
right.
general. It's not well
yep.
represented. And and these communities may need it. And so
right.
I don't want to overlook that. And I think the idea of having a good technical tool and having flexibility in how we allocate dollars locally is definitely a good thing. But at the same time,
yeah.
you know, let's
right.
keep the bigger picture in mind
right.
as well.
Yeah. Tom?
John, I'm a little confused because of the action. We don't have a quorum, right? It's not on the agenda. We have four agencies that I think may be able to work out some kind
right.
of a joint letter, which
right.
I hope they will do.
Right.
That would be best, but it might be appropriate for each of them to do their own letter, too, independent of doing one collectively. Or if they can work it out, I think it's fine. But I just wanted to bring the reality, which is we're basically discussing something that's going to fall in the laps of the directors of the four agencies to come up with a letter. So with or without us, I hope
yeah.
they'll do it quickly
right.
because the decision's going to be made
right.
fairly soon.
And I think that's the idea, right, that they're going to send a letter. Any other comments here? All right, I have one speaker card, Pat Eklund.
Thank you very much. I'm not sure. I'm Pat Eklund, City of Novato. I'm not sure that most of the people around this table know that I worked for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for over 35 years. And the last decade of my employment, because I retired last year, after 43 years, 7 months, and 11 days working for the federal government. So I retired last year. In the last decade, I worked with all the states in Region 9, but specifically in California. I worked with all of the state agencies to get their data electronically sent into a centralized database. I worked with OEHA. I worked with the ARB and Mark Stolling at the Bay Area Quality Management District. I worked with DTSC. I mean, all the environmental agencies, even DWR in California. And also the Department of Pesticide Regulation. I had a specific project on pesticide use as well as pesticide illness reports that brought in the labor aspect. But I wanted to also share with you, I'm on the Environmental Quality Committee for the League of California Cities and have served on that since I was an elected official in 1995. And before the EnviroScreen tool was released, we had CalEPA and OEHA come to that policy committee meeting where there's 50 cities, at least 50 cities sitting around that table across the state. And I would say almost all of them expressed concern about this EnviroScreen tool. And I think I talked to Gene about this some time ago at a couple of conferences ago. And I actually recommended to ABAG staff that the OEHA and CalEPA come down and give a presentation to the executive board for the Bay for ABAG, which I also serve on. Unfortunately, that never happened. But I really want to encourage this group to put caution on using that EnviroScreen tool. At this point, my personal opinion is that it should not be used for distributing money because there are a lot of problems with the tool itself. One of the things that I highlighted to the CalEPA secretary as well as OEHA when they were giving their presentation is that the data that's going into the tool is not necessarily what's actually being emitted. It's like permit levels in some cases, and it's not complete data at all. And I cautioned them before you release that screening tool, you need to make sure that the data is good. And it is not. There's a real problem with the state of California environmental agencies with sharing of data and getting data to be able to match. And I'm not going to go into all that, but I highly recommend, and I intend when I go up to the scoping meeting, next week to hopefully meet with the deputy director at Brad Paul's recommendation to let her know of some of my concerns, because I knew that this was going to happen.
So, do not use it.
I'm sorry.
Well, you know, the draft scoping plan came out yesterday. I just actually was up at the Air Board yesterday. The draft scoping plan came out and is going to get approved next week by the Air Resources Board. But just to know that the draft scoping plan is not actually authorizing this particular, to be really clear, it's not authorizing a tool. And I think a lot of folks have raised the same issues you have about this tool. And the reason I think the staff is working hard to make specific recommendations about the tool is because it appears the state is already down a track pretty far to utilize this tool. We may not agree with it, so we have to put our efforts where we will get the best benefit, which may be the policy issue that, and second, the specific changes to the tool that would, we think, be more equitable. I at some level, it may, you know, as much as we continue to say we don't think this is that this tool is the best thing, they seem to have already made, you know, a preliminary decision that this is the tool they're going to use, although we may try to change that. Okay. All right. Anything else? Okay. We have there's direction on that. Last item is report on Senate Bill 1184.
All right, thank you. I'm going to talk now about Senate Bill 1184, and this is for a regional strategy to address sea level rise around San Francisco Bay. And SB 1184, I'll go quickly since we don't have much time left today, but SB 1184 was introduced by Senator Lonnie Hancock, who is also ex officio to BCDC. And she introduced this after discussions with BCDC about the issues that we face in the region about rising sea levels and the work that we are engaged in with the JPC and others and what's needed for the region going forward. And so this bill, I've passed out the amended language to you, but in Section 2, it directs BCDC to prepare a regional strategy for rising tides in the region in collaboration with affected local governments and appropriate state and federal agencies. And then Section 3 provides for how the strategy will be prepared, and it has two main components. The first is a community planning component that we would do going forward, and that really is continuing the work that we have been doing in the Adapting to Rising Tides program, where we're working with voluntarily with local governments who want to work with us to look at the impacts and potential adaptation measures to their areas. And we think that this is work that's needed to be able to help us figure out how you really do a regional strategy in the region. And that would be combined with the second component, which is regional assessments, where we would look at the vulnerability along the shoreline in the region and do planning that would bring out adaptation measures and strategies that we could use to adapt to sea level rise. And the strategies to be guided by 13 goals and objectives that are in the bill. I'm not going to walk through them all, but they're drawn from the Commission's Bay Plan policies, Policy 6. And you'll remember that the climate change policies, when BCDC considered them, became very controversial. And the BCDC sat down with the various interests and the folks that had concerns about them, including the business community, environmental community, local government, and what came out of it for what the regional strategy should include were these 13 elements. And so what we thought was that this was a good integration of how the regional should approach, how the region should approach preparing a regional strategy, particularly because these were endorsed by the various groups at the end of that process. The bill directs BCDs to work in close coordination with this group, the Joint Policy Committee, as well as other appropriate state agencies, the State Coastal Conservancy, Ocean Protection Council, and the State Office of Planning and Research. And the strategy is supposed to be prepared so that it can be used as a part of the ongoing updates of the Sustainable Communities Strategy. It's supposed to be completed and presented to the state legislature by the end of 2018. We believe that the language in here is consistent with our Bay Plan climate change policies, as well as our commission's strategic plan, but also with the JPC and its work plan. You'll remember that we brought this to the JPC, and the JPC endorsed the idea of preparing a regional strategy to address sea level rise, and that BCDC and ABAG should work together in leadership to help the JPC prepare this. So this bill is written to be consistent with all of that. Where we are right now, the bill is supported by the East Bay Municipal Utilities District, EBMUD. The Bay Planning Coalition and the Nature Conservancy both had suggested amendments that they wanted, and so they took positions of support amended. I put this as amended because what I handed out is amendment language that is acceptable to them. And when we sat down with the Bay Planning Coalition, we had a good talk with the folks, a lot of the folks that we work with on the Bay Plan climate change policies, including Paul Campos of the Building Industry Association. And so we believe now that with these amendments that we can go forward with their support. And the Bay Area Ecosystem Climate Change Consortium, or BAKE, is also indicated their support as well. At this point, we have no identified opposition. And so the clarifying amendments in here basically state that this bill won't change the jurisdiction or the authority of BCDC. We're supposed to prepare a regional strategy as opposed to be doing something in the interim that would force anyone to do anything beyond what they would work with us voluntarily. And rather, we are committed to working voluntarily and collaboratively with local governments in the region, with the business community, with landowners, with the environmental groups, and all the other interested parties. It also clarifies that the draft regional strategy will be brought to BCDC for consideration and vote by two-thirds of the members like we do our Bay Plan amendments, and also that the JPC will review and comment on the bill as is actually laid out in state law right now. And the status of the bill is that it's passed the Senate Natural Resources Committee and is in Senate Appropriations because we have said that the bill may have considerations for general fund because it costs money to prepare a regional strategy, and we think that the state should help take this on. And so they're going to consider this by the end of next week. And that is the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and we have at least 5 minutes left.
This is informational for us because we know the agencies are each doing their own. Okay. Julie?
Yeah, thank you. ABAG's Legislative Committee took this up last night and looked at it, and I want to thank BCDC for making some rather dramatic changes to the bill. It is far more palatable than it was before. However, we have a request. in the very last paragraph, on the very last page, we would like to strike a couple of one phrase and one sentence, the entire last sentence and the phrase, we'd like to say that the regional strategy, along with the comments provided by the Joint Policy Committee, shall then be expeditiously submitted to the legislature for its consideration, period. Striking the phrase for providing future direction on actions to be taken, mm-hmm. because clearly, if you hand it to the legislature, they can do whatever they want with it. But please do not ask them with those last phrase and sentence to then dictate to us how we are going to use this information. I think those last couple of parts of that paragraph indicate to the legislature that we really want them to tell us how to manage our own business. And local agencies really do not want the legislature telling us what we must do. The last sentence that talks about putting together the regional strategy with legislation and directing the development of a shoreline resiliency plan, I don't care if we have a shoreline resiliency plan as long as we're the ones crafting it and we're the ones putting it out there for local implementation or voluntary regional cooperation. But I don't want to dictate and impose on the locals any more than we need to. So I think if we just say, we'll submit the thing to the legislature for their consideration, that answers the legislative mandate. That would be a polite request. Okay.
And that would be done. I think Zach made some comment about that before leaving, right?
Yes. We did sit down and talk with Zach, and we're fine with that.
But I think it's important to note that the legislature may, in its wisdom, decide that we need a regional strategy because you can't solve sea level rise one city at a time.
And John, I'm not contesting that. I'm just saying throw it at them and say, please now tell us what to do.
But I'm just saying that that's realistically what may happen is because ultimately a city next to another city is going to be impacted by what another city does or doesn't do on sea level rise, and leaving it up to each city individually to voluntarily implement a strategy may not do any good around the bay.
Well, that may be fine, but let's not tell them to dictate to us how to do it. We are all smart people, and we realize that the ocean doesn't stop at city borders.
No, but the point is that if the region develops a strategy, you can't leave it up to each of the cities along the shoreline to decide whether to implement it. So if the region, meaning everyone together, develops a strategy, then the strategy does no good if half the cities decide not to implement it because you need all the cities to implement it. That's the only point I'm making.
I understand that.
So it's something that we develop locally and hand to the state and say, but you're right. That change will leave it up to the legislature, but we're still developing our own strategy.
I'm not contesting that in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
But there is still an issue of local control.
I think there will be an honest difference of opinion in the region by folks about what should be done. That's what's going to happen down the road. I mean, everyone's going to have a different point of view about how to effectively implement it. And if City X next to City Y doesn't implement it, then City Y loses local control because City X is doing something that's affecting City Y that it wants to do, and it'll be impacted by sea level rise.
But John, all we're asking for is that it be a collaborative process. And frankly, if they're going to impose that we have to do this, then thank you, state legislature. Give us some money so that we can help you implement.
Right. Mark? Yeah. Did you want to add?
Yeah, and I think it seems like actually a relatively minor change because obviously the legislature can do whatever it wants, so we don't have to tell them that they can do that.
Right.
But the way this bill's written right now with those sentences in there, it reads as though we are preparing legislation for the state to regulate us. Yeah. That, you know, we're going to do this, we're going to pass it whether we act on it or not, and then it's going to go to the state and they're going to consider it for legislation. And that's like the whole plan is how is the state going to regulate us? And I just think that's the wrong assumption going in. I think we just need to have a little more open door in terms of what the possibilities are, and then if there's something the state wants to do with it, they can.
I think it's important to acknowledge that this is a BCDC-sponsored legislation, which is made up of folks from around the Bay Area and the state agencies, and the idea is to use local input in developing a plan, right, that can help address the issue in the Bay Area. Mary?
Just the point, Mr. Chairman, to your concern about whether cities or counties, if for that matter, engage in the plan or not, maybe that would be an appropriate time to seek legislative action, but prematurely would be inappropriate. I agree with the speaker. So that would be maybe an alternative plan, John, to your concerns.
I think BCDC intends to help work through the region in developing this plan and have it be locally developed.
Correct. I mean, that's the whole point. We keep talking about a bottom-up approach where we're going to be working with local governments collaboratively, and that's the intent of the strategy. That's how BCDC is preparing it. So so we're fine taking out that language. We don't want to give the intention that we want the legislature to tell us to do something.
Right.
We're trying to work something in the region of what we want to do, and we'll tell the legislature how they can help us.
Right. We may say legislature adopt this plan or not, right, Tom?
Yeah, I think I don't want to prolong this debate, but it seems like we should understand that I totally agree with the chair that eventually it's going to take some kind of state action in order for us to adopt a plan that's going to be uniformly adopted across the Bay. And it's kind of silly of us to think that we're going to, that's not where we're going to end up, because that's what we need to end up.
Right. And BCDC will make a recommendation, develop. In fact, the whole idea, I think, is to get at your point, Julie, which is we don't want the state telling us what to do. We'd like to go to the state and say, this is our local plan that we developed.
Implement our plan.
Yeah,
that's right.
That's exactly what
that's
I just said.
All right.
We're not inviting the state to do it for us.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Meeting's adjourned. This is good discussion. Good. Okay.